Welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Frank Lavin. Frank is a former Undersecretary of Commerce in the United States, and between 2005 and 2007, he was in charge of the country's International Trade Administration. He's been an ambassador to Singapore and worked in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. Between his political appointments, Frank has been a successful businessman who has mostly been active in the Asian region. A few years ago, he started Export Now, an e-commerce platform helping US brands to target the Chinese e-commerce market. I'm going to talk to Frank about trade relations between the United States and China, if current frictions will grow, or if both sides want to de-escalate and move away from confrontations. I will start, however, with some broader questions around the Trump administration and its trade strategy. Frank, welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast.
Thank you, Frederick. Glad to be here.
So I want us to talk about US trade policy and US trade policy strategy, both generally and vis-a-vis China and Europe. But I wanted to start off by talking about this general theme. You and I have done work together on the US trade deficit and how the deficit itself has informed the thinking about US trade policy. The underlying thought in much of the commentary that we've seen coming out from this administration is that a bilateral trade deficit signals a US weakness and consequently that the administration wants to connect that. But at the same time, we've seen that the trade policy actions that the administration has taken hasn't exactly had a benign influence on the trade deficit, and that much of the other economic policies that are pursued also lead to a widening of the trade deficit. So there seems to be something else at play here, that the administration is thinking in other terms on what it wants to achieve on trade policy. Some of it may be related to domestic policy, other things may be related to foreign policy. So I wanted to start off, Frank, by asking you, sort of, how do you sort of analyze the broad direction of U.S. trade policy and what lies behind it?
I think you framed it very well, Frederick, in that President Trump frequently does categorize U.S. trade policy in terms of a bilateral trade deficit, a global trade deficit, which is unusual for trade professionals, people talking about trade. But he invokes this data as an indication of unfairness or weakness or bad treaties, and holds it out as something that U.S. needs to change. On the other hand, it hasn't improved on his watch, even though he claims to have fixed NAFTA and changed the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement and now working with China. But none of the indicators on trade balance have improved. Not only that, as you indicate, we think some of the protectionist measures he's invoked have actually contributed to deterioration in the U.S. trade deficit because they made U.S. exports less competitive and made U.S. less inviting as a platform for manufacturing. So there's no question there's a contradiction between some of his rhetoric and some of his policies. And I came to the same conclusion you did, that he's really following more of a populist trade policy than necessarily one based on pure protectionism or economic nationalism. Meaning by populism, I mean he's driven by grievances or a sense of grievance that the United States is where it is today because other countries have preyed upon it and cheated it or maligned it or tricked it, and the United States needs to push back against this sort of hostile intent. And the evidence for this is the trade deficit. So it's not necessarily a coherent trade philosophy as much as it is the sort of raw populism and a sense of grievance that needs to be redressed.
And do you think there is any association at all between the actions that Trump is taking and that grievance-based orientation for the thinking on trade policy?
Well, there's points of overlap. They're not unrelated. But interestingly, if you were a U.S. president and you were really concerned about Chinese malfeasance, and I think Trump is right to put the spotlight on that topic. There is a lot of Chinese malfeasance on trade issues. But if that was your lead concern, you would try to address it, for example, by signing the TPP, or you would try to accelerate U.S.-European trade liberalization. So there'd be other tools you'd have that would sort of push China back or push America more toward fair trade without being protectionist and without putting up barriers. So the fact that he shied away from some of these other initiatives and he's put up some trade barriers, all the while pointing a finger at China says that there's something at play here other than pure desire for free and fair trade. I think he's got a political appetite for friction. He enjoys, at least in the early days, he enjoys turmoil. And it's interesting to compare what he's done with trade with what he did with immigration policy and health policy, the other major issues that he ran for in his presidential campaign. But he came in with very sort of accusatory language, very combative approach, total disregard for the status quo. It's older, he wanted to sort of do away with it and complete change, and then had very, very little progress in putting in any kind of new program at all. So trade, I think, should be seen in that kind of vein, that he likes upsetting the apple cart, and he's pretty good at upsetting the apple cart, but that he's weaker when it comes to assembling what comes next.
And how do you look at sort of the success or the failures that you've had with this general approach to trade policy? It seemed to work pretty well in the 2016 elections, and it resonated sort of with a constituency that were connecting both sort of blue-collar Democrats with blue-collar Republicans. But what about now? I mean, you get the feeling when you listen to not just Trump, but some of the other people in the administration as well, that they think particular actions they are taking to be cost-free, that you can raise tariffs on China, or you can do things with Mexico that is going to lead to new trade frictions there without it having any effect at all on the U.S. economy or U.S. exporters. So is this beginning to change,
well,
now, you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Frederick. Remember, the 2016 campaign, trade was useful rhetorical device to stigmatize President Obama and to stigmatize Hillary Clinton, because both of them had been working on trade issues and moving on the TPP. So first Bernie Sanders came out against TPP, then Hillary sort of did a reversal and said she was against it, and Trump sort of beat all of that. I mean, if you're going to support a protectionist, you might as well support sort of the most authentic protectionist or the loudest protectionist, and that happened to be Trump. So I think that the trade issues in 2016 had a utility for Trump beyond the particular economic matters. But one of the paradoxes that he's had to grapple with over the last 2 years is, even though the economy improved over 2 years, employment has improved, unemployment's dropped, he still has this accusatory bend on trade, that trade has ruined America and trade's cheated people and we've got to be tougher on trade. So I get the sense that issue, the saliency of this issue, has faded a lot. And at this present time, there's not a huge American constituency that subscribes to his theories of trade, but there is a constituency and it's part of his base. So he's being responsive to that constituency.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about China and the current confrontations that we've had over the past year between China and the United States. First of all, Frank, what do you think is the intention here on the part of the administration? Is it a purely mercantilistic intention, which is that they want to sell more American goods and services to China? Or do you think that there is sort of a long-term ambition here and actually get China to change some of its policy and to make it more of a market economy-based type of economy?
Well, I think it's very hard to answer that question, in part because Trump came into office without a long track record or any sort of track record in public policy. So his coalition ranges from mercantilists to protectionists to people who are China hawks. So there's a range of voices. I think the dominant voice tend to be the trade rationalist, trade representative Lighthizer and Mnuchin, who are I think more realistic about China policy, meaning they don't believe they can reshape China's economic model. They're simply looking for greater market access, greater intellectual property protection, sort of the typical goals of what U.S. trade negotiators have sought, just to fix some of the trade problems rather than reshape the Chinese economy. But there have been voices over the last 2 years, Peter Navarro, that are more mercantilist and view China more as a geopolitical threat, and call for more aggressive posture toward China. But we get the sense that Peter's voice is not the dominant voice in the trade negotiations.
And, I mean, you follow China very, very closely. And how would you describe the reaction in China to the more confrontative style that we've seen from this administration compared to the other ones? Are they willing to play ball, or are they just trying to sort of avoid doing anything and hopefully kicking this issue into the long grass?
No, I think President Trump, to give this man credit, I think he had a reasonably effective opening act, if you will, of shock value and establishing the tariffs. I think it really shocked China that this fellow needs to be reckoned with. And this was quite a shift from their policy toward Obama. I just don't think they took Obama seriously. I think they would, you know, always sort of be polite to him, but they never sort of tried to listen to what he was saying or try to respond to his statements. But with Trump, they've got to engage him. And they might not view Trump as always coherent or, you know, somebody who's subject to change of policies, but they were really struck by the imposition of tariffs. And I'll tell you something else. It was when Xi Jinping was having a meal with Trump at Mar-a-Lago soon after Trump took office that Trump ordered missile strikes in Syria. And that was in the middle of the meal. So they take his willingness to use force seriously as well. So I think they realize they've got to engage. They're prepared to make some concessions and make some offers and prove term trade. So in that sense, I think Trump will get some kind of victory out of this. I think the Chinese concerns are that twofold. One, they don't want to enter into an open-ended series of negotiations where every concession they make just gets a response from the U.S. of a demand of more concessions. So they're concerned about 2 years or six more years of never-ending sort of complaints and sanctions and penalties. So there has to be some kind of timetable involved with this. That's one concern. And the second concern is the Chinese government has to sort of own the decision. They have to be able to say to their people, we've made this decision on the merits. We didn't make it because of U.S. pressure. We didn't make it in response to anybody else. We've made it because it's the right thing for our own economy. In other words, all politics are local, and they have to be able to justify their steps to their own domestic constituencies.
I mean, to some extent, I mean, they are to blame themselves for being in that situation, right? So if you think about the Chinese way of dealing with confrontations with the United States, or for that matter, from other parts of the world over the past 5 to 10 years, it's always been to come up with new plans in order to buy more goods and services from that country. But that is a strategy that inevitably will become sort of a constant negotiation, because when you're not willing to move ahead with the type of changes to your policy that creates, you know, free and fair market competition, you always will be at the losing end of that game, right? So is this really sort of something that China can avoid, that Trump is going to come back 2 years from now and say, look, we didn't get enough the last time, now we want to negotiate again, because otherwise I'm going to reintroduce the tariffs?
Yeah, I think there is a problem if China gets into checkbook diplomacy and simply writes a check. And I take your broader point, too, that, look, China, there's been an ongoing debate in China between economic rationalism and economic nationalism. And, look, there is the same debate in Europe and in North America as well. But in those other two locales, the economic rationalists, at least in a relative sense, tend to dominate, whereas in China, the nationalists tend to dominate. So, for example, the average weighted tariff in the United States is 3.6% or something like that. In China, it's almost 10%. It's 9 point something, or not quite triple the U.S. So the point is, if you have that kind of policy, it's going to rankle. It's going to contribute to ill will, and you're going to have a sense in the U.S. of China not playing by the rules or not playing fair, and you're going to end up with somebody like Trump. So in some respects, I think they have brought some of these problems upon themselves. And I think you're also right, if they go down the path of checkbook diplomacy, they're going to simply raise expectations for continued checkbook diplomacy. But what they really should do, if we were talking to Xi Jinping, we really say, use this as an opportunity to rebalance your economy toward rationalism, to dial down some of your subsidies and some of your distortions, and use this as an excuse to trim your budget a bit. And you don't need the steel over capacity you have, and you could put some of these funds into pollution control, and you have a better society, and you wouldn't be stepping on toes in Europe and in the United States. So if Xi Jinping is adept, he'll sort of use this moment for some domestic reforms as well.
Yeah. So if you, Frank, were back in the administration, you worked, for instance, as the Undersecretary for Commerce during George W. Bush. If you were back in the administration, was going to advise the president on the strategy now, not sort of restarting the strategy from scratch, but the strategy now, what would you advise the president to do?
Well, I think Trump's in good shape, but I think you better cut a deal. You better, you know, the whole point of raising the friction, so to speak, with China is so that you can get an offer on the table and take a deal. So, and I don't know the precise calibration of where the negotiations are at this moment, but they should be able to offer greater market access, lower tariffs in some areas, greater intellectual property protection. They should be able to move on a series of fronts that will help the United States, but I'd also say we'll also help China. We'll also make China more efficient. The other point I'd make is to repeat a previous comment is, if I was really concerned about China and trying to move China the right way, I would relaunch TPP. TPP is already in existence, the Pacific Area Trade Agreement, but I'd see if we can now get the United States to join it, because that allows the United States to get benefits from more trade, but it also sends a very strong message to China that China cannot join the club unless it's going to play by the rules.
And how would you advise the president when it comes to collaborating with other countries vis-a-vis China? You mentioned TPP, and of course we have Japan in there. Do you see other possibilities with broader alliances with other parts of the world that could sort of help to put pressure on the Chinese governments to move ahead with market reforms that basically all governments complain about when it comes to China?
Yes, but I don't see an active coalition, because every country is going to have a different appetite, a different horizon, a different political leadership. The best thing to do is, rather than say we're all going to get together ganging up on China, the best thing to do would be for the Pacific-based countries to work on the TPP we talked about, and then for the Atlantic-based countries, which is to say North America and Europe, to work on a US-EU free trade agreement. So at least you'd get rules-based countries that are oriented toward more trade to work together and collaborate among themselves. So you're collaborating as an internal mechanism rather than externally facing China.
Yeah. So that's a good time to move the conversation over to Europe a bit and talk a little bit about your expectations for US-EU relations going forward. We've had frictions in that relation as well with the tariffs on steel and aluminium, the Section 232 tariffs. Europe responded with some retaliation. And of course, now the big fear in Europe, especially in Berlin, is that there will be tariffs coming on automotives as well, because there is another Section 232 under review looking into whether the import dependence on automotives is against the interest of national security in America. So where do you think Europe stands sort of in the broader analysis in the White House, or indeed in the US government? Is it sort of a must-have? You must have a good relation to Europe? Is it a relation that will be there regardless what happens? Is it a relation you think the administration is willing to invest something into?
You know, unfortunately, I think it's closer to your third supposition, that I think it's an open question the degree to which the current United States government thinks it needs to invest and cultivate this relationship. And and by the way, I think the shift sort of started under Obama, and it's more pronounced under Trump, which is to say both presidents I have a break with tradition in terms of U.S. international role and U.S. international leadership. I think both Presidents Obama and President Trump viewed that international role as costly and maybe not necessary, or maybe it could be reduced without any real problem. And so both presidents, I think, in their own way, have reduced the U.S. role in NATO. So the point is, I think if you take or reduce that geopolitical dimension of the relationship and you say that's not as important as it historically has been, you're really reducing some of the logic behind an economic relationship, because the United States and all parties, I think, viewed that economic relationship as one of the pillars of a very important relationship. But now if Washington has said, well, the relationship might not be all that important, it's not investing a lot of effort into improving the economic relationship.
No, that's the impression also you get when you're watching America from Europe. So a final question, Frank. So if you would advise European governments who have a very big stake, not just in the economic relations with America, but of course also in the security partnerships through NATO, what would you advise European governments to do in order to, in the first place, make sure that whatever interest you have they will be listened to and perhaps even attended to by the administration. And in the second place, that helps to take away some of the frictions and confrontations that are there in trade right now.
Right. Well, I'd say this. Europe also is got a more protectionist trade regime than the United States. Europe has higher overall tariffs than the United States, and it has higher tariffs, markedly higher tariffs on items like cars, automobiles. So my view is it would be a good opportunity for Europe just to trim some of those tariffs and demonstrate some capacity to move on trade even without U.S. leadership. In other words, Europe can lead itself. And I would say, look at the three big trade regimes in the world, U.S., Europe, and Japan. Those three might account for 70% of world trade, with China being the other big group. But I think if Europe were to say, we are not going to have a higher tariff than either Japan or the United States on any single item, we will not be the worst of our three main trading partners, we're going to reduce our trade, that would be it's just some improvements in various segments of improving trade. That would be a welcome step ahead. So my hope for Brussels would be that Brussels lowers tariffs, opens some segments up, improves competition and so forth, and sends the right message to Washington that it's serious about getting the economy moving.
All right, Frank. It's been a great pleasure to having you on the podcast. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, Frederick. It's been great to chat with you.
Super. Thanks a lot.